by bridging the gap to particle physics. And what I will be telling you about are sort of the very first steps of that that I think are promising and justify to take a closer look at that connection. And so this is mostly work that I'm doing together with my research group of PhD students and postdocs that is funded through the Emmanuelther program in Germany at the University of Heidelberg. So why do I think that this is interesting? So I think understanding quantum gravity and matter in the asymptotic safety paradigm is interesting because asymptotic safety might be able to provide us with an understanding of quantum gravity and standard model matter or possible extensions at trans-Planckian scales. So on the one hand, this might even be a fundamental model of quantum gravity and matter where you can really zoom into arbitrary high scales. On the other hand, because it is based on a renormalization group fixed point, this generates universality. And in that sense, such a fixed point can actually play a role for a much larger class of models beyond the Planck scale. So this can simply extend the range of quantum field theory beyond the Planck scale. It doesn't necessarily need to be fundamental in the strict sense of the word. And I'll be coming back to this idea later in the talk. So then the asymptotic safety paradigm is interesting because it can actually come with an enhanced predictive power. So what I mean by that is that couplings that are free parameters in an asymptotically free setting, and for instance, in the standard model, they could actually turn into calculable quantities from an asymptotically safe point of view. And of course, this is interesting for two reasons. First of all, this might then give us some explanatory power and allow us to understand some structures that so far we have simply put in numbers from experiment, but we can now understand the structures that generate these numbers. And on the other hand, of course, this then also subjects this model to testability. So this means that we can actually use, so to say, data for particle physics or our knowledge on particle physics to understand whether this idea of quantum space-time coming from asymptotic safety, whether that is actually phenomenologically viable or not. So what's the status of all of this? Well, first, indications for an asymptotically safe model of quantum gravity and matter exist, but there are a number of open challenges that I will be highlighting. So let me first of all review the status of the field as a whole before I'll then discuss specifically the connection to particle physics. So the idea of asymptotic safety is that there is a renormalization group fixed point in the space of all the couplings that are compatible with the symmetries. And this then provides a scale invariant regime that you can use to provide a UV completion. So such as renormalization group fixed point, if it is reached in the UV, allows you to zoom in to very, very high scales and thereby gaining an understanding of the microscopic dynamics. Then in this infinite dimensional space of couplings.
It's crucial that it's finite dimensional, right?
Yeah, so I'm coming to that, okay. Right? So in the space of these infinitely many couplings, there are two sorts of directions. One are what we call relevant couplings. They are associated to free parameters. And those are the infrared repulsive directions of the fixed point. And these free parameters simply parameterize how far you've deviated from scale invariance along one of those renormalization group trajectories. And these are simply parameters that have to be put in from experiment. Now, conversely, the irrelevant couplings, those are the ones that are infrared attractive, where you're automatically pulled towards the fixed point value and which are not by themselves associated to free parameters. Their values are really fixed from the asymptotic safety requirement. And so for this to be a model that has a finite number of free parameters, the number of relevant directions clearly should be finite. And the smaller it is, the more predictive the model becomes. And so here's the status of investigations into asymptotic safety. So this is mostly done by using the functional renormalization group equation. And that proceeds by taking truncations of this infinite dimensional space of couplings. And then one searches for a fixed point in these truncations. And then, of course, one of the crucial questions is what happens to the fixed point properties as truncations are extended step by step. And I would just like to highlight that this is a method that is actually much broader applicable than just to quantum gravity. It can be applied in basically most quantum field theoretic settings. And in particular, it can be applied to test interacting fixed points in a variety of models. So this includes, in particular, models which provide universality classes for continuous phase transitions. So these are interacting fixed points in three dimensions, For instance, the Ising model, the Grosnevo-Yukawa models, these play a role for graphene as well as multicritical points. And so here, this method of truncating theory space and then step by step extending truncations in some expansion scheme actually leads to both qualitative as well as quantitatively robust results. So the critical exponents that one obtains, for instance, in these settings, can be compared to other methods, lattice methods like Monte Carlo simulations, the epsilon expansion, the conformal bootstrap, and these results actually match up quite well. And so the method that is applied to then search for asymptotic safety in gravity is exactly the same. And what I'm showing you here is part of the work that the community has been involved in over the last few years, basically over the last decade or so. One starts with a truncation including the Einstein-Hilbert sector, so a cosmological constant and a Newton coupling. That truncation features a fixed point, and it features two relevant directions. And so one of the key questions is, does this fixed point persist under the extensions? But also, as we extend truncations, does the number of relevant couplings or free parameters actually grow? And so here you can see that as you extend to higher powers in the curvature scalar, as well as including more complicated tensor invariants, the fixed point always persists, and the number of relevant directions doesn't increase much beyond these truncations. Yes?
Because how do you use this Ising model? So what's in the infrared for the Ising model?
So what you use here is just a Z2 symmetric quantum field theory in three dimensions, and that then features an interacting fixed point, the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. And those critical exponents are exactly the critical exponents of the IC model.
That's
an infrared fixed point in the sense that if you start with the model at the Gaussian fixed point, you are driven towards the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. But of course, a fixed point as such doesn't come as a UV or infrared fixed point. It just comes as a fixed point. And whether you reach that fixed point in the UV or in the infrared is a question of your initial conditions. So if you set your initial conditions differently, one and the same fixed point can be approached either in the IR or in the infrared, sure. Right?
If you perturb the Ising model, you get the gauss.
Sorry, say again?
If you perturb the Ising model, you get the gauss theory. There is just nothing in infrared. So how can you follow back from the infrared to the Ising model? I don't understand.
No, so the Wilson-Fischer fixed point in those settings where you start from a UV complete theory is the infrared fixed point. But in general, of course, such a fixed point, you reach it in the UV if you flow along the critical hypersurface from the starting conditions down here. But the same fixed point would be an infrared fixed point for trajectories that are off the UV critical surface.
I don't know
right?
in which set these are examples of asymptotic safety.
Ah, so it's an example for an interacting fixed point. So that model, of course, isn't asymptotically safe because the fixed point is realized as an infrared fixed point. It's an example because they're all interacting fixed points. And to characterize such a fixed point, it doesn't matter.
Hang on. So
to characterize a fixed point, a priori, it doesn't matter whether it's a UV or infrared fixed point. That is just a question of where you set your initial conditions. Because for one and the same fixed point, you flow into it as an infrared fixed point if your initial conditions are on the infrared critical surface, and you flow into it as a UV fixed point if your initial conditions are on the UV critical surface.
Since you are being interrupted, so is there some organizational principle in the study of these operators? I mean, there can be lower dimensional operators that are to the 34s. Which, like, you know, contractions of the Riemann tensor, for example, or coupling of the, various invariants to scalar fields or to fermions. So are they not have been studied, or what's the, I would have thought that there would be many more free parameters coming from those operators.
Oh. So maybe let me highlight the example of the Gorov-Sagnotti counterterm, right? That's the two-loop counterterm from perturbation theory. It's the Weil tensor cubed. So it's precisely one of those examples which you mentioned that if you extend in a derivative expansion here, then this is one of the next terms that contribute. And this, if you add this to the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, it just generates a fixed point, and that just corresponds to an irrelevant direction. So in fact, what you see in this direction of higher order, higher powers of the curvature scalar is a pattern where the canonical dimension acts as a good guiding principle for the scaling dimension. And if you look at the Gorov-Sagnotti term, that falls into that same pattern. But of course, testing more complicated tensor structures at higher orders is one of the outstanding challenges.
So we don't know how many relevant directions.
No. So I would say this is a lower bound that converges under the extensions of the truncation in these directions.
So was Riemann squared tested or not?
Well, so, I mean, Riemann squared, you can just re-express that using the Gauss-Bonnet invariant into these two.
Into fermions or to scales.
So in that case, it hasn't been included yet. Mm-hmm. So that actually...
I guess my confusion is that mm-hmm. I can have many UVQs that flow to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I decide which I'm going?
So the many UV theories will have some new degrees of freedom or some new symmetries kicking in at some stage.
Degrees of freedom, honestly.
So I would just define it, or let's say I don't talk about degrees of freedom, I talk about the field content of the model.
This is what I don't understand. In quantum historical theory, there is no fields.
So this is the assumption that a path integral formulation based on the metric actually does make sense as an approach to quantum gravity, at least for a range of scales. And of course, so this whole program, in some sense, you can view this as a way of testing whether this assumption makes sense or whether it is impossible to formulate a quantum theory.
For a range of scales, you show plots where the normalization scale like runs 10 to the 20, the Planck mass. So what do you say? You are supposed to be expanding to all scales, according to what you say, but you don't know what the UV competitions, you don't know.
So,
is the theory unitary?
That's a different question. But so let me come back to this question of, is this sort of a fundamental model necessarily in terms of taking the scale to infinity or not? I'll come back to that later. But maybe to... So maybe can I answer your first question on the sort of uniqueness of the UV completion? So if you define a theory space, and that is defined by setting up a certain collection of fields, and specifying the symmetries, then there's a uniquely associated theory space. And then you can understand the RG flow in that theory space, and you can search for an asymptotically safe fixed point. If there is such a fixed point that you then connect to infrared physics, that does not prove by any means that there isn't any other viable UV completion. It just means that that could be a viable UV completion, and then, of course, there are other possibilities where you have added new degrees of freedom, new fields that come in at some scales, where the symmetries have changed at some scales. So all of this is possible. So this by no means...
Quickly coupled, how can you talk about fields? So are things quickly coupled, always along this flow?
So they don't seem to be too strongly coupled in the sense that if you look at the critical exponents here, that you can understand them as a measure how far you deviate from perturbativity, then the critical exponents, the higher you go, the closer they actually match the scaling dimension. So at these higher orders, they really converge towards the scaling dimension. So there is a deviation from canonical scaling, of course, because otherwise you would have the Newton coupling being irrelevant. But the deviation from canonical scaling seems to be only minimal in that sense that it is exactly what you need in order to be asymptotically safe, but not more. And so it seems that this is, in some sense, non-perturbative, but really only as non-perturbative as it needs to be. So I wouldn't necessarily describe it, for instance, as strongly coupled in the sense that QCD is strongly coupled, where you then have all sorts of phenomena like chiral symmetry breaking and confinement. Okay, let me just skip this plot. This is just to highlight what happens in this particular truncation, just to give you a flavor of the results. And let me now come to the particular topic that I'm interested in, namely adding matter to that setting. So why am I interested in adding matter? Well, simply because if you have such an asymptotically safe fixed point, assume it was there, and you get it simply from quantum gravitational degrees of freedom, then of course adding matter degrees of freedom to that picture, matter fields can completely change the picture because their fluctuations will contribute to the running of all of these couplings. And so therefore, in order to really gain an understanding of quantum gravity that possibly could apply to our universe, it's really crucial to add matter to this picture. So in my view, matter really matters in quantum gravity, and so therefore I've been pushing this idea of understanding how the fixed point changes as we add matter fields. And as you can see here, some work has already been done on that. For instance, we've looked at the effect of minimally coupled standard model matter on the Einstein-Hilbert term. This has then been picked up by other groups and confirmed by their results. More recently, this has been extended to higher powers in the curvature scalar, and we've also taken a look at non-minimal extensions both for scalars and fermions. But as you can see here, of course, this work is much more recent and it has only just started, so we haven't yet reached the same level of more extended truncations than in the pure gravity sector. But the key message is that the fixed point for minimally coupled standard model standard model fields in the truncations that have been studied, it persists.
Since you are at the UV fixed point, so there must be huge anomalous dimension, right? At least for the Ricci scale.
Yeah, for that, yes.
Why? So this maybe kind of resonates with the previous question. So why do we know that matter is more or less classical? Or are you assuming that matter sector, even if I put a scalar field, it has some... Well, what's the anomalous dimension for the scalar field?
Yeah, so in fact, the anomalous dimension, of course, as I just said, for the Ricci term, has to be enough to actually shift this from irrelevance into relevance. Otherwise, you cannot have a fixed point. But as I've been emphasizing, these higher order terms, they seem to follow more or less a canonical scaling. Now, if I add matter to the picture, I can calculate the anomalous dimension, for instance, for the kinetic term. And they do deviate from zero, so it's an interacting fixed point. But they aren't huge in the sense that the anomalous dimensions are typically bounded by something like one in the truncations that we've explored so far.
For a real scaly field, what's... For instance, you're going to tell it later? I don't want to sidetrack your talk.
Mm-hmm. For a real scalar field, I mean, the anomalous dimension depends on the number of fields that you add, because that also shifts the fixed point value. But in a range that is sort of the standard model meta range, the anomalous dimensions do stay approximately bounded by one. I would have to look up the exact numbers for a specific number of meta fields if you're interested in the exact number.
It's by one, it's order one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
sorry, what do you mean by confirmation? What is this truncation that you're using? How do you pick the truncation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are, of course, different ways of picking the truncation. And what is really critical or really crucial in these results here is exactly this pattern that I've been showing here, that if you want to understand the relevance or irrelevance of an operator, it seems that that actually follows canonical scaling rather well. And that seems that implies that if we use an expansion exactly in such a way as a derivative expansion, then although there is of course no proof, these results suggest that very high order operators will actually just be irrelevant. So of course in principle it could have been completely different, and then it would have been much more difficult to devise reliable truncations.
To the confusion, what is this UV compression that you're talking about? Is it a good theory? Is it theory, how do you even check? Because you're using these truncations like they're patch factors.
Maybe just raise your question again on the next slide, because I would like to exactly point out the open challenges of this. So the status so far is that there is a fixed point in a set of truncations, and so far no truncation has been found that doesn't feature that fixed point, and there is apparent convergence as you go towards these higher orders. But what are actually the open challenges in the field? There are quite a few challenges that the field as a whole is facing, and I would like to explain why I've actually picked one particular one that I think is particularly important. So clearly one of the challenges is quantitative convergence, just extending truncation step by step and understanding whether the results reach a status where the critical exponents have reached an apparently converged status or not.
So you say you can apply it distinct to things like the Ising model.
Yeah.
So you can really get anomalous dimensions.
Yeah.
Of the Ising model?
Yes.
Perturbatively?
It's not perturbative. So the functional renormalization group setup is a setup that you can apply to perturbative as well as non-perturbative.
How do you do calculations here?
Mm-hmm. So in practice, the Wetterich equation is structurally a one-loop equation, but it depends on the full propagator that you get in that truncation. So it's not the perturbative propagator. Structurally, it's a one-loop equation. So structurally, the calculations that you do resemble one-loop equations, with the difference that the loop integrals are actually UV and infrared regularized by a regulator that has been put into the theory. And there is a vast literature for statistical physics for the Ising model. People have looked at that at various orders in the derivative expansion, and you can actually see that the critical exponents, the anomalous dimensions. So for instance, the critical exponent for the Ising model, 0.63, is something that you can reproduce in a derivative expansion to sixth order, and that has been done by the group by De La Motte and collaborators in France already a few years ago.
I think the question is the right question. They use the Wetterich equation.
How do you get the propagator?
Say again?
How do you get the propagator that you put in?
They use the Wetterich equation, which is like, it's like the Polchinski equation.
I asked the same question I asked from Wednesday. What is the graviton propagator in theory? When you go to higher energies above the Planck mass?
That's a very good open question. It's one of the challenges that this field is facing. So let me continue.
Make predictions if your theory is fundamentally sick.
No,
if you have a property,
so whether the theory is
like 1/p², how can you make any predictions?
Whether the theory is fundamentally sick or not is an open question.
Yeah, but it's not. It's been open for 40 years. Okay, so how?
Oh, that
I address this.
Sorry,
yeah.
So how can you make predictions if your theory is sick?
Maybe
could we maybe just okay, let's agree on organizing a little bit the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she could, I think it's important we have a discussion about all this point, but maybe she could present a little bit. I mean, what I'm thinking is that she's using the RG flow with the hypothesis that there's a fixed point, and then trying to read off from the anomalous dimension near this infrared point some prediction. So a priori, and she said, it doesn't seem that she has to believe that it's valid up to the UV, but she might present
yeah.
that later. So at this stage, it's an effective description of what happens if there is some fixed point, what are the consequences?
Yeah, so
it's an effective description.
I'll come back to that question.
Like hopefully,
and
some of the people who have not...
And then
we'll
see where
it more
goes. No?
I mean, but
the question is whether the truncation is an approximation scheme, a consistent approximation scheme, or is a brutal truncation that you say, okay,
mm-hmm.
I draw these terms.
I think
are you going to couple it or not?
Yeah.
Yes or no?
She,
are you going to discuss the truncation later on? Because some of us might not have seen this before.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I'm I've already shown you the truncations that have been studied in pure gravity, and
no,
I mean, you know, this is...
If you
this
show
is,
the truncations, then
must question.
Would you mind
why
that I finish? So I mean, you know, this is a large field where quite a bit has happened in the last 10 years. So within a 1-hour talk, I cannot review everything that has been done in detail. So coming back to this question of whether it's a consistent truncation or not, this really hinges to a large extent on the fact that we find in these truncations that the bootstrap hypothesis we put in, namely that canonical scaling is a good guiding principle, that is what comes out. So if we put that in as a hypothesis and then we find that the anomalous dimensions deviate strongly from the canonical scaling, then that of course means that this truncation scheme is not particularly useful. So it turns out that is not the case. And so we're working under the assumption that that is something that will continue, that pattern will continue, and therefore we can work in truncations that we set up guided by the canonical power counting.
Can you calculate scattering cross-sectional gravitons above the Planck scale?
You can try to do that in an approximation within the approximate truncations. Yeah.
But then how do you know that this is a consistent thing to do if you don't know how the gravitons propagate or go?
But so I think most of the models in quantum gravity are facing challenges at one or the other point. I don't think there is a theory that is completely fully developed and fully understood, and this is the same for this theory here. Oh yeah, sure. There are theories that address the unitarity problem. There are theories that have other problems, so I would say it's a fair statement that every quantum gravity approach does have some open problems, and I mean, I was trying to go through the open problems that this particular approach is facing.
Where would you put failure in a theory? I mean, what unitarity, I mean, as far as we know, unitarity is very well preserved in the standard model.
Can I also come back to this question in terms of interpretation of all of this as extending the sort of an effective field theory setting? I will come back to that a little later in the talk after I've presented some of the results. So a key open question here is Lorentzian signatures. So these calculations are done in a Euclidean setup in order to apply the renormalization group. And so therefore understanding whether they can be continued to a Lorentzian signature is another important open question. And as a first step, one can work in an ADM decomposition that is, of course, not Lorentzian, but that means that the configurations that go into the calculation, each one of them can be Wick rotated. So this you could think of as a first step towards a Lorentzian setting. Background independence is another question because the regularization, the regulator, of course, means that we need a notion of locality in the sense that we want to decide that we want to do a local coarse graining scheme. So we need to decide what are the high momentum modes and what are the low momentum modes. And we do that with an auxiliary background metric. And then it's key to ensure that the results are independent of that background metric. And a key step here is to distinguish the background graviton propagator from the fluctuation propagator. And as you can see here, this is very much ongoing work. There are also other ideas, for instance, connecting to an alternative background independent approach, such as tensor models. That's also work that I'm pursuing with part of my group in Heidelberg. Unitarity, as we've discussed, is an open question. Of course, in a quantum gravity setting, the question is also, what do you actually mean by unitarity? So here we'll interpret that as the statement that the flat space propagator shouldn't have any poles with the wrong sign. But of course, in a quantum gravity setting, it's not necessarily clear that doing a flat space approximation at very high energies is actually the thing that you should be doing, or whether the consistent background that you should be using is actually something different from flat space. So if we work under the assumption that this is the propagator that we should be looking at, then there's a proposal that was made already a few years ago by Dario Benedetti.
Are you saying you cannot calculate probabilities?
No, I'm just saying that the interpretation of unitarity in a quantum gravity setting might be slightly more involved than it is in a standard quantum field theory where you are given a flat background.
How can you make predictions in the context of that theory? So you pick and choose what things you predict or not?
So maybe we can discuss this question a little more once I've told you a little bit more about the results.
Okay, go on.
Thank you.
Maybe it might help. Is that, can you treat, you know, for people with reason, can I just treat the approach you're giving as an effective
yes.
approach? In which case, you know, it has to be completed.
Yeah.
But and the question is whether this effective description
it's
is
a unique fixed point.
Hang on. So I was coming to this description. So fixed points, of course, they can dominate renormalization group flows also for settings where the renormalization group flow passes close to the fixed point. So if you have a setting where you don't come from exactly the fixed point but from some other UV completion, then nevertheless you are drawn towards that fixed point along all the infrared attractive directions. So you could in principle imagine that there is a setting where beyond some scale in the trans-Planckian regime there is some fundamental UV completion that we don't know what that is. And that fundamental UV completion then just gives you values for the couplings at that very high trans-Planckian scale. Now, if there is an asymptotically safe fixed point, then this will actually draw trajectories towards it along its infrared attractive directions. And then towards the infrared, you emanate out of the fixed point along the infrared repulsive directions. And then in the far infrared, for many settings, this looks like you're coming from close to the fixed point. So the fixed point scaling, in particular, if you pass very close to the fixed point, it will dominate over a large range of scales. And therefore, the infrared will effectively look very close to an asymptotically safe setting, even though at very, very high scales, you do have another UV completion. So in that sense, asymptotic safety can actually, or this asymptotically safe fixed point can shape renormalization group flows, and thereby also what happens in the infrared, if it's not a fundamental setting. And of course, in that case, the question of unitarity isn't one that shouldn't be addressed in this effective setting, but one that should be addressed by the UV completion. And for practical purposes, pushing a quantum field theoretic understanding of matter and gravity beyond the Planck scale in a trans-Planckian regime is definitely something that is very interesting to do, even though this might not be the fundamental theory in the sense that you can really take the scale to infinity, but you can actually only take it to some very high scale in the trans-Planckian regime. And so all of these are questions that the community is very much aware of and working on, as you can see here. But the question that I'm trying to push is one which says, well, let's assume we could even make a consistent model out of that would nevertheless not tell us anything about whether this has anything to do with the description of reality. So the key question really is, if there is such an asymptotically safe fixed point, can it have anything to do with viable phenomenology? Is there also any way to subject this quantum gravity idea to tests? And here I'm advocating a connection to particle physics, and this really exploits one of the strengths of the asymptotic safety program, because it is a quantum field theoretic formulation. It means that the bridge to particle physics is easier to build than in many other quantum gravity models, which really depart very much from a quantum field theoretic setting, and so it's very difficult to say what meta degrees of freedom even are. And so this is the particular challenge that I'm focusing on, and that what I would like to discuss in some more detail. And so this brings me to the idea to get the top quark mass from asymptotic safety. Now, what do I mean by that? In particular, why do I imagine that there should be quantum gravity effects at the electroweak scale? So the top, I mean, lives way beyond below the Planck scale. Why should Planck scale physics have anything to do with the top? And so let me explain in a little bit more detail why that should be the case. So the effects of asymptotically safe quantum gravity on matter are actually twofold. So first of all, asymptotically safe gravity induces higher order couplings, that is, even at the UV fixed point. So these are part of the microscopic dynamics, but they, because they are higher order couplings, they actually remain irrelevant at the interacting fixed point, and therefore below the Planck scale, they are very quickly suppressed by a canonical power law. And so just as you would expect, these are very, very tiny at the electroweak scale, and therefore these have nothing to tell you about potential observable consequences. So the key point here is that in the truncations we've looked at, asymptotically safe gravity generates a fixed point in the marginal couplings. And the marginal couplings of the standard model, those are the ones that feature a logarithmic running below the Planck scale, and therefore they keep some memory of the ultraviolet physics. So the key idea will be that asymptotic safety generates particular values for these marginal couplings at the Planck scale, and since they only run logarithmically below, the value at the electroweak scale is still sensitive to what the value at the Planck scale was. And that's the key difference to these higher order couplings.
Why do you believe that marginal couplings in the standard model are still marginal at your...
No, this will be exactly the point. So the marginal couplings of the standard model will actually be turned into irrelevant couplings at the fixed point. But because they are marginal, they continue to run logarithmically below the Planck scale, where the quantum gravity effect that turns them marginally irrelevant, where that effect has switched off. So let me highlight the potential mechanism for this retrodiction of the standard model couplings, and that could apply for marginally irrelevant standard model couplings. And I will single out the top as an example. So here I'm showing you the one loop beta function for the top quark from the standard model with the gauge contributions and the contributions from the top Higgs sector. And this is the diagrammatic expression underlying the functional renormalization group. You see that it's structurally very much a one-loop equation, but there's this additional regulator insertion, which shows you already at the diagrammatic level that it's not quite the same as one loop. And this allows you to calculate the gravitational contribution. All of these diagrams are proportional to to one power of the Yukawa coupling. And so the quantum gravity contribution in the setting from the FRG turns out to be linear in the Yukawa coupling. You can then think of this Fy as encoding the effective strength of gravity fluctuations. And that can, of course, be calculated within particular truncations, such as, for instance, here the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where it's proportional to the Newton coupling and cosmological constant.
Sorry, what is the role of the cosmological constant? How does the cosmological constant come in everything?
Mm-hmm. So the cosmological constant is part of the couplings in theory space because it's compatible with all of the symmetries. And so if you evaluate the effective propagator that goes into it, in some sense, the cosmological constant appears like a graviton mass, simply because it's not a momentum-dependent term. And so all of these metric perturbations here, the cosmological constant also runs. And so the cosmological constant is one of those terms that approach a fixed point. It remains relevant at that fixed point, however. So the infrared value cannot be determined from the fixed point.
The other question is, I mean, I don't understand it. I mean, we measure it at low energy. We know the cosmological constant. Do you fix it to be the value at the low energies? Or?
Yeah, so it's one of the relevant couplings, which means we cannot say anything about its value. We can only ask whether the measured value can be reached on a trajectory that comes out of the fixed point. And the answer to that is yes, but there is no prediction of the cosmological constant or anything like that. So in some sense, the standard hierarchy question of why that particular value for the cosmological constant and not some other trajectory on which the cosmological constant takes another value, that question persists in this setting.
Why? I have another question. Why the top Yukawa? Why there? We have all sorts of Yukawas. Mm-hmm. So why do you pick the top Yukawa?
Yeah. So the top Yukawa is of course the one which has a sizable Yukawa coupling at the Planck scale. I will talk a little bit about an extension to the top bottom at the very end, so maybe we can come back to the question then.
The electron Yukawa. So if you want to extend everything to fixed point, you have to prove everything runs to fixed point. Why do you ignore the tau Yukawa? Why do you ignore the neutrino Yukawas that you need to give them masses? Why do you ignore the electron Yukawa?
So all of these are interesting questions, but I mean, we are proceeding step by step. So first of all, we are trying to understand whether for one of these couplings, such a construction makes sense in this approximation. And if the answer is it doesn't make any sense, then we don't have to extend towards the rest of the standard model, right? So we are proceeding step by step. We can't obviously tackle all problems simultaneously.
Excuse me. Sorry, I have kind of a question. But so you have several Feynman diagrams on the stem there.
It's not Feynman diagram. It's Feynman diagram like, but this is really just the diagrammatic expression of the Wetterich equation. So this regulator insertion is sort of really the only hint that you get that this is not a Feynman diagram expansion.
The insertion are like propagators of the graviton?
No, so these are insertions. They are just appear in the structure of the Wetterich equation. And these regulator insertions, you can think of them as actually regularizing the UV part of these loop diagrams. So these will be simple loop integrals, but by the presence of the regulator, they are simultaneously infrared and UV regularized. And so these loop integrals are always finite.
Okay, so you make an ansatz, which is this Einstein-Hilbert truncation plus the Yukawa coupling.
Plus kinetic terms for the scalars and for the fermions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then you put this in the Wetterich equation.
Yep, and then this is sort of the diagrammatic representation of the gravitational contribution to the Yukawa coupling. All of the rest is just the standard contribution. And then you just calculate those. And then this is the expression that you get out in this truncation.
You don't have to specify a background.
No, so I can do this on a flat background. I can also choose to do this on a curved background. I'm getting exactly the same result.
Just a question.
Yes?
I see powers of couplings in the beta function. Mm-hmm. So this is presumably a perturbative expression.
Mm-hmm.
And there are numbers.
Well, so it's,
there are specific numbers in front of those powers of the couplings. Are those the same numbers I would get with Feynman diagrams?
Yeah. So the Wetterich equation, if you apply it to a setting where you just put in marginal couplings, then the universal one loop coefficients are just reproduced. And so these are just the universal one-loop coefficients.
These are just one-loop
answers. So this is the universal one-loop term that you have in the standard model, and it's exactly this term that comes out of the Wetterich equation. So, I mean, I'm not showing this sector here diagrammatically, but this calculation gives you exactly the same as you would get from a perturbative calculation. Okay, so now let me elaborate a little bit on what the consequences of such a contribution are. So you can see that if this gravitational contribution is positive, then the beta function is simply positive, and the fixed point at zero is infrared attractive, and that means that the top Yukawa is simply pulled towards zero, and it remains zero at all scales. It's zero at the Planck scale, nothing in the standard model regenerates it, and so this would give you a vanishing top mass. And so if the quantum gravity contribution for this number is positive, then that would be a phenomenologically not really acceptable setting. So on the other hand, if this number is negative, then you first of all get an UV-attractive free fixed point. And most interestingly, you get this interacting fixed point. And as you can see from the beta function, this is infrared attractive. And because it's a fixed point at a finite value of the Yukawa coupling, this will translate into a finite value of the top mass. And I will tell you exactly how this happens. So first of all, the crucial question then is, since we have a regime which is phenomenologically not really acceptable, and a regime that potentially might, it's crucial to understand what the value of this contribution actually is. And in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, it turns out that the back reaction of matter is actually really crucial. So here I'm showing you the G lambda plane. There's this red region, which is actually excluded because there is no fixed point in higher order matter.
How are these free parameters? With measured cosmological constant low energies, you have to run them high. How are these free parameters?
They are not free parameters, right? But I can just look at this expression in this plane, and then the next step is to understand where is the fixed point, right? So of course, in the truncation, there are no free parameters. But before I look at the beta functions for the Newton coupling and cosmological constant, I can just take a look at this plane and understand what happens in the different regions. And so what I'm showing you next is exactly the point that we need to determine the fixed point value for those under the impact of matter. Because here's what happens if you only take into account the vector bosons and the scalars in the standard model minimally coupled to Einstein-Hilbert, then the fixed point falls into this regime, which wouldn't be phenomenologically acceptable. And now the impact of fermions actually is to shift the gravitational fixed point value. So as I've said before, matter really matters. So the back reaction of matter on the gravitational fixed point is crucial. And you're moving through this plane. And at three generations, we are actually obtaining a fixed point value that lies here in this regime where this Fy is negative.
Does the lambda equal to minus 5 mean?
Yeah.
Sorry, say again?
Does So here you have lambda, and it's just somewhere between minus
five. So this is the microscopic value of the cosmological constant.
Units of what?
Yeah.
It's made dimensions, so it's in units of the RG scale.
So what does that mean?
In order to get something like asymptotic safety, you don't need to look at the scaling behavior of the dimension full couplings. You need to look at the dimension the scaling behavior of the dimensionless couplings. So what this means for the dimension full coupling, if you translate it, simply means that you multiply it by the RG scale k squared to get the dimension, and so the dimension full cosmological constant then blows to minus infinity at this fixed point. But
the actual value of the so again, when calculating this regime, a graviton scattering, g varies with momentum. So all
yes.
propagator varies with momentum.
Yeah, so g will actually go down with 1 over p squared.
So then there's a propagator that appears to be going like 1 over p to the fourth.
No, it's not clear what the full anomalous dimension of the graviton propagator is. I mean, as I've said before, this is something
we're just asking about lambda. So mm-hmm. So to get to minus five to become 10 to the minus 100, whatever.
Yeah, but so this is in units, right? So you can now ask, well, you know, I now have this fixed point. Can I now get the observed value of the cosmological constant as I flow to very low scales, right? And the observed value of the cosmological constant in this picture here is something that is realized along this trajectory passing really, really close to the Gaussian fixed point. Because if it does that, then over a large range of scales, the cosmological constant will be constant and very, very small. But you need to pick this one very specific trajectory here. So this is just the sort of standard hierarchy problem rephrased in this language. Because you can see there are many trajectories that flow out from the fixed point towards the infrared. So in principle, you could have picked any of them. To get the observed value, you need to pick this very particular one. But of course, you could ask, why this particular trajectory? And there is no answer to that in the asymptotic safety setting, because this is one of the free parameters. OK, so.
I still don't. So can you write mm-hmm. down what's the relation between you? I had this question many transparencies before.
Mm-hmm.
Lambda and g, I figured, must be dimensionless because there is minus 5 there. So what's mm-hmm. the cosmological constant? I thought it's in units of M Planck.
No, so these are all made dimensionless by using the renormalization group scale.
Can you write down on the blackboard what's exactly the relation between Newton's constant and your g?
So this will be g over k squared, where k is my RG scale, and the dimension full cosmological constant is the dimensionless one by k squared. And so then I calculate the flow for these dimensionless quantities.
So if I go to the infrared as k goes to zero, so I see that Newton's constant gets very large.
But see, so these quantities, they have a non-trivial scale dependence, and these reach the UV fixed point values, and they also flow towards the infrared. And if you look at the particular behavior of the Newton coupling on trajectories, then the dimensionless Newton coupling goes to a constant in the UV, and it scales so that in the infrared, it eats up this scaling, and the dimension full Newton constant is just constant. As you would expect, below the Planck scale, there are no quantum gravity effects, so the Newton coupling is just the constant that we know.
So basically, the physical quantity is the product of the two.
You can think of it this way, that you can define a physical quantity by taking the dimensionless product of the two.
So those guys are functions of k.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And so this is exactly what you see along this flow. Okay, so now we've seen that including the back reaction of standard model matter, in particular of fermions, in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, in this approximation brings us into this regime where such an interacting fixed point exists. But then, of course, there is additionally the contribution from the gauge sector, so we need to understand what that actually does under the impact of asymptotically safe quantum gravity. And this is, again, the subject of a number of papers over the last years, where there is a quantum gravity contribution to the running of the gauge couplings, where, again, this is a function of the Newton coupling and cosmological constant in truncations that turns out to be smaller or equal to zero. And that means that in the trans-Planckian regime, once this contribution kicks in, these couplings are all driven towards a free fixed point. And so this means that at the fixed point, we can then switch off this contribution. But of course, to understand how the fixed point for the Tokyukawa, how that connects to the Tokyukawa in the infrared, we need to take into account the finite values of the gauge couplings at trans-Planckian scales. And so now putting all of this together.
Can you explain a bit, what is this FG? Does it depend on truncation? Why is it proportional to GI? Why aren't there, gravity is strong. Why aren't there other powers multiplying this factor?
Mm-hmm. So if you just look at a truncation, Einstein-Hilbert plus the gauge terms, the field strength square terms, then this is the form of the beta function that you get. It's essentially a very similar calculation to the one that I was showing for the top Yukawa. You can calculate that in different truncations.
When you talk about truncations, mm-hmm. like they're God. So what are these truncations and what do they mean physically? What do they do?
The truncation
that just fix whatever problems you think your theory has.
The truncations are just approximations to the dynamics, and we're doing the best that we can on a technical level. We have particular guiding principles to select the truncation, such as, for instance, by canonical relevance. But of course, a crucial question is whether these results converge under extensions of the truncation or not. So we certainly do not pick various truncations and then pick the result that we like best. These calculations are technically way too involved to actually do several truncations and then pick your favorite results. So we are technically doing the best that is possible. So I'm not showing the calculations here, but in fact, it's quite involved to arrive at these results here.
And to be fair, the truncation you're using is essentially...
It's a very simple truncation.
Locality. Right? You're using locality, and then you're checking whether this hypothesis of infrared locality survives the presence of
physics. You can view it in that way. But obviously, one of the crucial outstanding questions here is to understand what happens under extensions of the truncation.
It looks very nonlinear, that your FY, so it's like, all, there's something you were implying, like all loop exact or something.
So this is one of the consequences of the Wetterich equation. So it has a propagator that you can view as resumming certain contributions from perturbation theory. And this is where this contribution comes
from. There could be other terms you can write down that enter the same order, which is outside your truncation.
Exactly.
So I'll be coming back to this question. And I absolutely agree that checking what happens under extended truncations is clearly one of the key questions. So I'm not claiming that.
Then I cannot write down the denominator. I have to, if lambda is small, then I have to do linear expansion of that FY.
So this is within this particular approximation, and I will show some results. What happens as we go beyond this truncation? So first of all, let me just quickly highlight the results. So we have this collection of beta functions for the top Yukawa, the gauge couplings, Newton coupling, and cosmological constant. Putting all of that together gives you this fixed point that I'm showing you here. And then there are relevant directions that are associated to the low energy value of the Newton coupling and cosmological constant. And these three parameters we use so that we reproduce the low energy value of Newton coupling and cosmological constant. And in turn, this then determines this transition scale from fixed point scaling to where gravity effectively switches off. And then below, we just follow the one loop running within the standard model. And in this simple approximation, we are getting a top mass that is somewhere in the vicinity of the observed value.
So again, how can you extend, you say, where do you reach the fixed point? You reach the fixed point at the Planck scale?
Yes.
So then what happens afterwards if you don't know the UV completion of your theory?
Mm-hmm. So depending on how close you pass to the fixed point, you will stay at these approximate fixed point values for a range of scales. And you might depart further on. It's a question of whether your trajectory is leading.
Again, I'm asking, can you calculate your top scattering above the Planck scale?
I haven't done that, but within this approximation, I could look at the graviton-mediated top scattering.
Yes,
but that's a different physical question.
How can you calculate? You don't know if the theory is unitary. How can you calculate anything?
So within approximations, I can nevertheless ask the questions that I'm asking. And then, of course, understand what happens step by step as I extend these.
But sorry, if the theory is not unitary, the answer you will get will be nonsensical.
So we don't know whether the theory is unitary or not.
Okay, there you go. So
but it's, that's what I said. It's one of the open challenges of this field to understand whether it's unitary or not.
Make any predictions and write, extend all those. Why not cut off, put a blank back in your scales above the Planck scale and just stop there? And say, I don't know how to calculate, I don't know if the theory is unitary, I don't know how to calculate probabilities.
So I can make the assumption that quantum field theory can be extended beyond the Planck scale to include gravity, and then I can calculate within approximations, and these are the results that I get. Okay, so let me...
The predictions you're making are not predictions about the physics of the UV. The predictions you're making are infrared predictions.
Yeah, I would not view them as predictions. I would view them maybe as consistency checks. And I would say that if in these simple approximations, these consistency checks fail, then this means we need to include new physics into the picture. If in these simple truncations the consistency checks work out, then that's, I think, good motivation to explore this further.
So we should have these rational functions at lambda. I imagine if I were to expand them into power series, these would reproduce some perturbative.
It's not necessarily clear to what perturbative scheme this would correspond, right? I mean, you can have different schemes, but of course you can do a map between perturbation theory and the FRG. So there are papers which look at exactly this question.
I see a lot of integers. When I look at perturbative calculations, I see a lot of transcendental numbers. It's kind of curious to see. I'm trying to figure out how could it match.
Yeah, so I'm not sure whether you can in a simple truncation match to perturbation theory beyond one loop order. So to recover all of the coefficients from perturbation theory, I think you would have to go to a very high order. The higher you go in the truncation order, the more closer you will be able to recover the coefficients from perturbation
theory. Is it lambda or not? Is the small order small lambda in your formulas or not?
No, I mean, so this is not expanded in small lambda, right?
The previous term.
Yeah, yeah.
But is lambda small? So when...
No, so I mean, the fixed point value that I mentioned as lambda is just some number. So this is the fixed point value that just comes out of these beta functions.
No, but you were writing down the Feynman diagrams, right? Or some sort of...
These are not
Feynman diagrams. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we were to expand it in some sort of Feynman diagram, so would lambda be a small parameter or not?
So I would say expanding this in Feynman diagrams, I'm not quite sure whether that would make sense, because you do need an anomalous dimension for the Ricci term that gets you to this asymptotically safe fixed point. Right, so from perturbation theory, of course, you could think about doing perturbation theory in 2 plus epsilon expand 2 plus epsilon dimensions, doing an epsilon expansion that you then Padere sum. But for that, in order for that to be meaningful, you need to go to at least fourth order or fifth order in the epsilon expansion. And the orders that have been explicitly checked are first and second order. But of course, in principle, you could try to actually make the connection to perturbation theory in an epsilon expansion. And I think it would be very interesting to actually check that. It's technically, I think, very, very challenging to do that. Okay, so let me highlight a few key points. So first of all, again, reiterate, why do I think that quantum gravity should have any relation to the electroweak scale? Well, it's because there's this trajectory that comes out of the fixed point that gives a unique value at the Planck scale, and there's only logarithmic running below, and in that sense there's a memory of the Planck scale value. So it really relies on the fact that the marginal standard model couplings, that asymptotically safe quantum gravity makes a contribution to them. Let me also highlight that this perturbative predictive trajectory acts as an upper bound, because all of the values for the Yukawa below this critical trajectory are actually attracted into this free fixed point, whereas all of the values above simply correspond to UV unsafe trajectories. And now maybe let me come to this point that we've already discussed a little bit, namely, is all of this actually relevant if you don't think asymptotic safety could actually be a viable fundamental model of gravity? Let's assume that there is, beyond some scale, a UV completion that we don't know what it is. It could be anything. But let's assume that the scale where this UV completion kicks in is somewhere beyond the Planck scale, so that there is a finite range of scales that we would have to bridge. And assume that in this regime, a quantum field theoretic description of gravity and matter makes sense. And then in this regime, these calculations here would tell you that within this approximation, there is a fixed point, and the fixed point here is infrared attractive. And so the effect is very clearly visible here. Imagine that your UV completion kicks in somewhere here, and you don't know what it is. So in principle, you could have a large range of values, for instance, for the Yukawa. But the fixed point here is infrared attractive, and so it pulls all of these different trajectories towards a smaller infrared window at the Planck scale. And so in that sense, the fixed points generate infrared universality, and that is the same here. The key idea is that this fixed point is an infrared fixed point in the sense of the Planck scale being infrared. So it's an infrared fixed point for models that live somewhere at trans-Planckian scales, and where you're then driven towards a smaller range of values, where you can then say, well, relatively generically, it would appear that maybe whatever the UV completion is, you are very likely to land within a certain window for the top Yukawa cup.
But how do you...
Yes?
You want the UV completeness to appear at scale which are higher than the Planck scale,
yeah,
or lower?
Mm-hmm. So this would be beyond the Planck scale, so that there is a finite regime, right? Higher in energy. So that there is a finite, so a smaller distances, right? So that there is a regime where I can say, well, a quantum field theoretic description where quantum gravity as metric perturbations is present. And so this would be the regime that would be described, what would be dominated by this essence, particularly say fixed point. And that would have the effect that whatever the fundamental UV completion would be, this funnels a range of values to a smaller range of values at the Planck scale. And in that sense, I think these ideas could potentially also be of interest if you go beyond asymptotic safety as a sort of fundamental model. And if you just ask, well, what if we are more agnostic? We don't really know what the UV completion is. Do these calculations then nevertheless tell us something? And because these fixed points are infrared attractive, the answer would be yes.
Just now, why don't I have a fixed point, you know, at scales which are intermediate between now and the Planck scale?
You could also have that. So then you would, if that would be a fixed point that includes quantum gravity, you would have to make the assumption that the scale at which quantum gravity kicks in is below the Planck scale. Of course, that's a consistent possibility.
Well, it's just that the scale of approximations that you can continue to flow stops before quantum gravity kicks in.
So this doesn't necessarily have to be the Planck scale, it just has to be the scale at which these quantum fluctuations of gravity take an appreciable effect. And of course, in principle, I mean, there is no measurement of that scale, we can be agnostic about where that scale lies precisely. Okay, so let me very briefly, since I'm running out of time a little bit, tell you a little bit what we've tried to do by going beyond this very simple truncation here. First of all, we've looked at an estimate for the systematic error that our truncation induces by looking at the variations under a change of the regulator. And what you see here is what I would say that in these approximations, a value for the top mass that is roughly of the observed order is more or less robust within this parameter space. But of course, the number that we are getting out of our particular truncation should not be taken seriously at the moment. So these ellipses here show you that when you vary the regulator, you do get quite a significant change. So that definitely means that more work needs to be done on extending these truncations. You can't take that number too seriously at the moment. You should think about the sort of ballpark of numbers.
You have negative cosmological constant.
Microscopically, right? So on the during the flow, you actually flow towards positive cosmological constant if you pick this one particular trajectory that I was explaining.
Well, it looks like on your plots.
No, so this is the fixed point value, right? So this is the fixed...
You're saying this lambda of k is some complicated functions that I don't see anywhere.
So I was showing you the flow here. So this is the microscopic value, and you then flow along such a trajectory towards positive lambda.
Doesn't look very stable on that plot.
No, so this is exactly what I said. So this is exactly what I said. The cosmological constant is connected to a relevant coupling, so it's a free parameter, and that means you pick one trajectory. So this simply means that this is not a model with zero free parameters. It has a few free parameters, and they just correspond to picking trajectories.
It's beyond. You have to fine-tune all the time to stay on your arc.
So I wouldn't say it as a fine-tuning. I mean, once you pick the trajectory, you just stay on that trajectory. Now, of course, you can ask why was that particular trajectory picked or not some other, and maybe something beyond quantum field theory can answer that. But I mean, any relevant parameter in a quantum field theory brings this problem that you have to specify the initial condition on an RG trajectory. Okay, let me very briefly highlight that we have taken a look.
What happens if you have a phase transition, so you have a finite correction to the cosmological constant? Does that kick you out of the trajectory in your picture?
So of course, then this means that at that particular scale, the trajectories change from what they would be without that phase transition.
Yeah, but this is what I was asking. So this is an unstable point that
gives.
No, it just means that the sort of initial condition that you choose is different in the case where you do have the phase transition than the one that you choose when you do not have the phase transition. So I mean, this is the usual, if you want, hierarchy problem for the cosmological constant. It just re-expressed in this language. So we're not solving the cosmological constant problem. If you're wondering why the cosmological constant is so small in this in our universe, then asymptotic safety, from all that we know, cannot provide an answer to that.
I think things are maybe a little bit even worse. So even the two parameters that you have, even you know, within this two parameter space, G and lambda, the trajectory that you need doesn't look stable. So you need to tune even there. And I'm saying that that trajectory, as you pointed out, has been picked up by setting up all the couplings to zero except for square root of G and square root of G times R. So so all of these couplings, so not only you have to stay on that, but then you have to ensure that all these other couplings are not being generated. You're saying it's too complicated to check, but it looks like
So for every coupling that is a free parameter, there's always the question, which trajectory do you choose? And of course, within truncations, trajectories look different than if you extend truncations.
I don't have to choose anything. I have a theory.
Of course.
The RG flow will tell me.
No. And any relevant parameter, any marginally relevant parameter is connected to a marginally relevant coupling is connected to a free parameter. That's just standard in any quantum P3, and that doesn't change here at all. Okay, so maybe let me very briefly, because I'm running out of time, explain a little bit about the effect of higher order terms in the graviton propagator. So this is a first step towards testing what happens beyond. So we have taken a look at what happens if we extend the truncation by R mean U squared and R squared. And then these functions that enter the beta function for the Yukawa coupling and the gauge couplings, they become functions of all of these fixed point values. And what we have done so far is to understand that in this extended parameter space that now has two dimensions more, there remains a regime that is green in the sense that the top mass that will come out of that will be finite. And so this means that extending the parameter space by these two additional dimensions, the regime where in principle such a mechanism can work, so this extends this green regime here, this is then an enlarged space. What is left to do here is to calculate the back reaction of matter onto these fixed point values to understand how much the value for the top changes under this extension. And finally,
is the line, the fixed point, where is this fixed point?
So we haven't calculated the fixed point here. So this is just a truncation that we have used this to calculate the effect of gravity on matter. The back reaction of matter on the gravity side is one of the things that is on our to-do list. So I can't give you the fixed point at the moment. So let me also very briefly mention higher order gravity-induced matter interactions. These are another direction along which you can expect contributions. And these include for fermion couplings and momentum-dependent fermion scalar couplings. And we have shown explicitly that these particular ones, if we extend the truncation by these, which are the leading order generated ones, if you follow a derivative expansion, then their contribution is actually suppressed compared to the direct gravitational contribution. So this just gives a very subleading correction. You can check that explicitly, but there's also a structural argument because these fixed point values are actually proportional to the fixed point value for the Newton coupling, but they enter into the beta function for the Yukawa coupling through an additional matter loop, and thereby they are suppressed by an additional loop factor. So let me not, for the interest of time, talk about the extension of the top and bottom, but I'd be very happy to answer questions about that if you're interested. Let me just briefly summarize. So what I've shown you here is that I think there are intriguing first hints for a connection between particle physics and asymptotically safe quantum gravity, where in approximations we are finding a fixed point regime that can then be connected to something that could look similar to the real world. The potential mechanism that allows us to fix some of the free parameters of the standard model in this setting is that anti-screening gravity fluctuations balance the screening matter fluctuations, and conversely, you can think of this as restricting the microscopic gravitational parameter space. So if you want to know whether there is at all a region in the gravitational parameter space where you could have potentially a fixed point that is viable, then these calculations give you some answers about that, because they tell you, well, part of the gravitational parameter space, even if there is a fixed point, is actually excluded because it doesn't fit to this, to what we know about our world below the Planck scale. And so I think this is really worthwhile to follow up in more detail. And so for the future, there's of course a number of things to be done. And I'd like to thank you for your attention. I'm looking forward to further questions.
Questions? I have a silly question. So if I go, what would the
Schwarzschild black hole look like? So mm-hmm. if I approach, so would there be some signatures? So if I go close to the horizon, right? So the effectively mm-hmm. K, is that correct assumption that effectively K will be very large? Or I should use what value of K I should use in mm-hmm. in this picture?
Yeah. So I mean, in a black hole setting, if you want to have an idea of what possible effects of this could be. This has been done in a setting where you take the classical Schwarzschild metric, and then you say, well, but G is actually now a running coupling. It depends on K. And then, of course, the crucial question is, how do I identify this gate? Exactly as you were asking. And people have argued that, well, where would you expect quantum gravity effects to begin? Well, somewhere close to the singularity. And so you would use...
Singularity. I think I have a huge blue shift before I get to the singularity near the horizon.
But if you just look at classical gravity without matter, right, then you would say the effect should kick in the vicinity of the singularity. And so you would then associate the scale K with the geodesic distance. Right? So let me finish.
Yeah, I don't understand. You make a statement and I don't understand. That's mm-hmm. why, you know, you keep going there, but I'm lost because, you know, if I compute effective temperature as I approach horizon from the outside, right, the effective temperature diverges at the horizon. Mm-hmm. So if I use temperature as a proxy for mm-hmm. the value of K I should use, it looks like to me that even for a large Schwarzschild black hole, I should use the effects mm-hmm. of whatever it's called. I have seen this the first time in my life, so mm-hmm. I'm sorry for stupid questions. So, but that if that's the case, there has already been placed bounds on mm-hmm. how far are we from Einstein gravity. Mm-hmm. So given that you're making these predictions, and so you have some numbers that you are having, So have you studied, or, you know, first of all, is that correct what I asked, that the value of, basically, K should diverge at the horizon? That's what I naively saw.
So I think that's a hypothesis that you can make, but so there are a different hypothesis that you can make about the scale identification. So the literature that exists on this subject is where people have said, well, we expect the effects to actually kick in the vicinity of the singularity, because the scale that should set K should be something like the Kretschmann scalar. And if you then identify K with the Kretschmann scalar, then you do get essentially no effects at the horizon. You only get quantum gravity effects in the vicinity of the singularity. And because the dimension full Newton coupling goes to zero quadratically in the scaling regime, this looks like a weakening of the singularity. Now, I think this idea of associating it sort of with close to horizon distance is definitely something that is interesting, but it's not something that, to my knowledge, has been done in literature so far.
And there is some deep understanding why it has to be associated in particular with the Kretschmann scale.
So
why K has to be associated with Kretschmann scale?
No, so I would say that these studies where you know start from the classical metric and then you do this, what people call RG improvement, those are at the level of sort of quantum gravity-inspired models. So this is not a derivation of the structure of black holes from this model. This is just a guess at what possible quantum gravity effects could be. And because you can make different assumptions for how you would identify the scale and you would possibly come to different conclusions, this in some sense already tells you that only some of this will be robust. So I think if you use the scale identification that you're proposing, you would get the similar effect for the vicinity of the singularity. You would probably get a weakening, but the conclusions about the horizon structure would be different. And so therefore, I would say, well, then this is definitely where such a sort of RG improved model breaks down, simply because depending on different choices of your scale identification, you arrive at different conclusions. Then these are not physically robust results.
So the case of quadratic gravity that you showed before, so the fixed points are not known even without the matter fields?
No, without matter fields, they are known. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as I've been showing you in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, the back reaction of matter is really crucial for the fixed point value.
Okay.
And so therefore, this is an outstanding question. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fixed point values are known without matter.
Okay, and what are they? The plots that you show, or?
So I didn't show the fixed point values for R squared and R mu squared. I would have to look them up. I think
different than the ones.
Yeah. So this is not the asymptotically free fixed point. It's a different fixed point.
Different.
Yeah. It's different,
okay.
Which you can also see by the scaling exponents. Yeah.
Just to make sure I understand, when you write this formula with the g and lambda,
mm-hmm.
so you basically I think the interaction with those two terms, you do a one-loop calculation of the beta function concatenated to those two, and you integrate that on the scale.
So what you do is that you choose this for the effective dynamics, so the Einstein-Hilbert term, and from that you derive the form of the propagator in this truncation, and this you then plug into the Wetterich equation. So this is just an equation that does a regularized loop integral over the propagator, so it will be automatically UV and infrared regularized by a regulator, and so this is then the beta function that you get. So structurally, it's very close.
With these two terms in the action.
Mm-hmm. So structurally, it's very similar to a one-loop calculation. But I mean, of course, the cosmological constant appears like an effective mass term, and this leads to these effective terms. Whereas if you would do
also the board used only the things involving these two terms, not hundreds or thousands of terms.
So what people have done in pure gravity is where you can actually also go to higher orders in the curvature. Right, so where you don't only include the effect of Einstein-Hilbert, but then in your denominator you do have additional contributions from the higher order curvature terms.
And so powers of R.
For instance, powers of R as well as R mu squared or the Gorov symmetric.
Functions with extra powers of R included.
No, so these are just the functions that you get out by doing all of the different diagrams for the contribution to the Yukawa coupling for the G and lambda. And because
so this calculation you showed us were essentially one loop. Beta function.
No, but you're.
I think you can.
You're resolving diagrams with.
No, it's not.
No, but I think you should.
Beta function, I mean, integrating beta function is a summing, right?
I don't think that shows what the Wetterich equation is.
So maybe let me briefly show you what the Wetterich equation actually is. Maybe that will help to understand a little bit. So the Wetterich equation comes from a setting where you look at an effective action, but one that you obtain by doing the path integral in a momentum shellwise way, so this is in a Wilsonian fashion. So you introduce a mass-like additional regulator term, and this term is chosen such that it vanishes in the UV, so it doesn't do anything to these high momentum modes. So these are integrated out. They contribute to the effective dynamics. And the low momentum modes, they are suppressed. And in this way, you define an effective action that only contains the effect of high-momentum quantum fluctuations. And then what we use is the scale derivative of this flowing action. And for that, starting from this from this definition, you can define this exact equation that is formally exact. It will no longer be exact in approximations. But what you see here is the following. So you specify an ansatz for the effective action, some truncation. From that, you calculate the second functional derivative, add the regulator term and take the inverse. So this is like the regularized propagator in this setting. And then there's this additional scale derivative of the regulator. That is what makes the trace here UV finite. And so this trace essentially is just tracing over the eigenvalues of this full propagator. So in flat space, this will just be a momentum integral. And so structurally, this is like a one-loop equation. But of course, you have this 1 over gamma 2. And if you put in higher order terms in your gamma, they will all appear in the denominator. And so this is where structures with 1 over 1 minus 2 lambda and so on come from. And you can view them as effectively resumming some class of diagrams, but not in the sense that you can, in these simple truncations, do like a one-to-one mapping to a particular perturbative approximation. Yes?
So, I mean, solving this equation, I mean, if I was to solve this equation, I would just rediscover Feynman diagrams. I mean, the solution to this equation is given by the integral which can be expanded in Feynman diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
So you've avoided using Feynman diagrams, but I mean, does this technique really, is it more powerful? It seems to be equivalent.
So I would say that it's powerful in the sense that, I mean, structurally it's one loop and very similar to Feynman diagrams, but because you use the full propagator, not just the perturbative propagator, you get effects that would be higher order in perturbation theory by doing a one-loop integral. And the cost that you pay for that is that you're no longer exact because you have to make approximations here. So I don't think that it's completely, you know, that it's impossible to do these things with perturbation theory. Just this is just a tool that is particularly convenient because it has been shown to work rather well in settings where you have interacting fixed points in theories which have terms which are not just marginal terms. So in fact, for instance, these examples for the Ising model, there you can use really truncations that are rather simple to do, which you can really do like in a few lines, to get results for the Ising exponents, which are reasonably close to the full ones. And so it's just appears to be a powerful method to deal with this sort of setting. But of course, in principle, you could also try to extract the same results from perturbation theory. So it's not that this is inequivalent to perturbation theory. Obviously, it's all derived from the same path integral.
One should also say that, in principle, one should solve this equation. You're not doing it, right?
Well, so I mean, you know, to find a solution to this would be equivalent to solving the full path integral exactly. It would be absolutely awesome to do so. You know, if you have the trick to do so, please tell me.
Yeah.
The best that we can do is to do these in approximations.
That's
right?
Why the equation is useless, because you cannot solve it.
No, it's not. Every method has systematic errors, right? Perturbation theory has errors. The lattice techniques have errors. No method gives you an exact result. No, I mean, so what is the method that? So what is the method that gives you an exact result? I think every method has systematic errors, right?
And is there a small parameter?
Yes.
Is there a way to control? In perturbation theory, there is only two, because there's a control parameter.
Yeah.
That
so you can apply this. You can apply this to perturbative settings, and in that case.
But you're not doing it.
No, but so you can apply this to perturbative settings, and in that case, you just, I mean, so this just then recovers things like the one-loop effect of action from perturbation theory directly.
Yeah, but how do you know this is a good approximation for gravity, which is strongly coupled at the Planck scale?
So I would say we don't know how strongly coupled it really is. So we are making the assumption that it is strongly coupled enough to generate an interacting fixed point, but not more strongly coupled, and then we test this assumption approximation. But of course, ideally, it would also be very useful to test this with complementary methods, like for instance, lattice techniques, like the causal dynamical triangulations, Euclidean dynamical triangulations, are programs that are tackling the same path integral, and of course, the lattice also has systematic errors, but different ones from this. And so I think ultimately, to really show that what we are doing is something that isn't a truncation artifact, it will also be really useful to connect more closely to other methods.
Okay, an even more naive question. So when you go to the Planck scale, do you add all possible, so naive dimensional analysis tell you should have all possible operators of R to all orders of 1 over the cut of the theory, 1 over M Planck. You're not doing that, are you?
But we are not doing that, but the dimensional analysis also tells you that the couplings of all of these higher order operators, they are more and more irrelevant. And so if you're thinking in terms of an...
That doesn't make sense. When you do scattering through those operators,
So I was just making a statement about the canonical dimension of those couplings.
Yes, exactly. So
the only thing that I mean is that the dimensions of these couplings are more and more negative. And at this interacting fixed point, we are finding that...
But that what you're saying doesn't make any physical sense. Again, the question is, you do a calculation of cross-section and you have all those higher-order operators. We know from when we do perturbation theory, we know it will break down and we can identify the scale where this is break down. How do you have control of your theory above the Planck scale?
Well, I mean, the idea of an asymptotically safe fixed point is...
I understand the idea, but I don't see it with your mathematics. You haven't shown this.
No, I'm not claiming that we have shown this, but
okay,
we have...
Then why are you predicting the top mass if you haven't shown that the theory even makes sense?
So I'm trying to subject the theory to a different type of test. I think there is a variety of different tests that you can make.
But
and even for a mathematically consistent theory, it's a question whether you can actually connect that to viable phenomenology or not. So I think pursuing all of these avenues at the same time, testing both more formal questions as well as questions of phenomenology makes sense, because if you can show that even if such a fixed point existed, it wouldn't connect to the real world below the Planck scale, then it doesn't make sense to understand this fixed point further.
The top mass, another 40 years down the line, you find that this truncation is, which already is a bit nonsensical, doesn't even make even less sense. So what do you do?
So I don't think the time scale for that is on the order of 40 years. I think the time scale for that is on the order of a few years, because we have been making progress in extending these truncations. and we will be able to see whether...
Truncations. What is your control parameter to tell you that truncation is a good approximation?
Yeah,
well, I understand
that.
No, I'm asking...
Yeah. So I maybe try the interpretation, she could tell me if I... So that... What I understand is that she's making a strong assumption that somehow it makes sense.
But this is...
Okay, which is a strong
assumption. It's a huge assumption.
It's a huge assumption. Then she's saying, well, if it makes sense, what does it does to my infrared world here? And then you're asking, how do you know it's consistent? I say, well, I don't know, but at least I want some kind of... The way I understand is that there's a test of self-consistency. Suppose... So I got a conclusion based on one truncation. If I go one step further, do I go away from my previous conclusion, or do I converge into the same conclusion? I mean, you could think of, you're saying perturbation theory, that's what you do. You say, you know, you add one more term, and you say, well, is that term smaller, or does it completely affect the previous
result? But you can choose the term.
She can do as good, but you would say that based, she's... There's a way to test your assumption. It doesn't mean it's really correct. It's consistency. Like,
but this is, it's not clear. You have to make sure. How do I know that this system doesn't have a pathology that even... enough fudge factors to predict the top mass, whatever you want it to be. But what if the theory, even if you predict the top mass, what if the theory doesn't make sense? Let's say there is a big pathology, like a ghost, or some particle that makes the universe decay in infinite rate.
So
that you wouldn't know. You don't know.
But so I would just like to push back on the question.
I would say there should be a way you should know. Like if your theory is pathological, at some point you...
Because they don't know what the graviton propagator is.
She cannot analyze all the possible operators.
Exactly.
So within the class of operators, she discusses.
She can
analyze the stability of her hypothesis.
We are going to R to the 34th, but there are many more operators before I reach R to the 4th.
Which
I actually asked the question to which I did not get my answer. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the... If I'm sitting at the fixed point,
mm-hmm.
the dimension at the fixed point of the Ricci scale?
The dimension of the Ricci scalar? So that would be the inverse, so the critical exponent associated to the Newton coupling minus 4. So the critical exponent that is associated to the Newton coupling is of the order of 2. So that's a deviation from the canonical dimension of this coupling of 4.
Well, so my question was I'm just slow. So what's the number?
Mm-hmm. So it's just the dimension of the coupling minus 4. So if you have a
model with the models that you match whatever the mass of the top scale, what's the dimension of the Ricci scale? Then
mm-hmm.
we will know how much you're correcting the dimension of the length.
And
we can see, you know, because you're talking, we are modifying it, but not modifying too much. I know that to take a Ricci scale, I have to take two derivatives. So I know what the classical dimension of Ricci scale is. If you're going to give me the answer in your particular model, then I will know how much my meter, what the dimension of the units of length changed. And then I can judge for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, you know, in a weakly coupled or whatever you are doing or not?
Mm-hmm. So the dimension to the operator is just related to the dimension of the coupling. That's the way that I'm used to thinking about it. And the dimension of the critical exponent associated to the coupling is of the order of 2 instead of minus 2. And so you get the corresponding shift in the Ricci scalar. So as I've said before, for the Ricci scalar, that is quite a significant shift, because that is the shift that you need in order to compensate the canonical scale dimension. Otherwise, you don't get asymptotic safety. But then the question is whether this shift is actually the same over all operators, or whether this shift changes.
You're making assumptions about truncation. I'm going to make assumptions.
Could I finish my sentence?
Yes, please. But give me the number without talking. You're talking too much.
Sorry.
Just a number.
So I think the number should be it's a shift by 4 from the canonical dimension.
But changes into more. So I'd say it's
completely
a huge.
Huge.
But
it's absolutely huge. It's like your T2L.
But
non-stop in terms of winding.
But can I add the comment that this shift in the scaling dimension doesn't have to be the same for all of the couplings in theory space. And this is exactly what is happening in these truncations. It's only for the Newton coupling, But for all of the higher order operators, the shift from the canonical dimension is smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the shift that you get for the r to the 34 is actually very close to zero. It's nearly the scaling dimension. And so in that sense, it's not...
What's the dimension of that guy?
By the way, yeah. In any CFT, no matter how strongly interacting the dimensions of certain classes of operators deviate little from the classical values.
I'm not sure that that's necessary. I mean, you could have strongly coupled CFTs where you have strong anomalous dimensions, right? But I mean, so it's not...
No.
But here it's not clear whether this is...
an anomalous dimension of operators of high charge.
Okay, but so here it's not clear whether this is a conformal theory or not. It could also just be a scaling rate theory. But also...
A lot of operators have a dimension which changes just a little bit, and
oh, yeah.
They're very not with the coupled.
But the square root of G is roughly the same as the other one. So I would measure my length going back to the statement of, okay, fine, the Ricci scalar you are saying is hugely normalized. But the square root of G roughly has to get the same shift, right? Because those are the two ones that you balance with respect to each other. So if I use square root of g to measure distances, then is it like dimension zero? So from being mass dimension one, my length goes to dimension zero. Is that correct?
So for the cosmological constant, the critical exponent is of the order of two, which is close to the canonical dimension. So I don't think from that you would get such a huge shift. So I think if you want to understand the exact shift, you have to look at the precise operation.
Yeah, I think, sorry. Yeah.
So I guess the question is, there's if I understand properly, there's kind of two questions. You're talking about the stability in terms of the conformal dimension, or the dimension. Some operators deviate drastically, and that's why you have new physics, R and R squared, and you're saying the higher, the higher derivative operator don't. And then the question here is, well, okay, in some sense, how does that interface with recoupling? Or like, for you, it's a consistency check. And I think the question is that might not be because there's a question between the relationship of this instability of the conformal dimension, which is important with the strong coupling.
I don't think the question of strong coupling is maybe that sort of has a yes or no answer, in the sense of that it depends on what operator you're looking at, how large the deviation is. So since for most of the operators it's rather small, in that sense I would call this weakly coupled.
Any more questions from another part of you? Okay, good. Thank you.